Hello and welcome to the Think Global People and Relocate Global podcast series. We're looking at emerging trends in global mobility, and today's subject is how the global mobility sector is adjusting to hybrid and remote working. Some very interesting questions and topics to be discussed today. And to discuss this, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Dr. Sue Shortland. She's a senior lecturer in human resource management at the University of Westminster, and Fiona Murchie, who is the founder and managing director and managing editor of Relocate Global and Think Global People. Welcome both. So Sue, it's great to have you here. And I just wondered, first of all, with thinking about hybrid working in relation to global mobility, what are the benefits of it and why is it important for companies to get their policies right and understand the requirements of employees when they ask for it?
Yes, Marianne, it's a very important and topical issue, actually. And for companies, it's important because they want to attract and retain and motivate the best talent. And people today are interested in and highly motivated by having international experience. And that's primarily because it gives them sort of personal development, professional development, and of course it gives them career development as well. So it's good for them in terms of their long-term career outcomes. So for employers, if they want to attract and retain the best people, they need to offer these kinds of opportunities that give opportunities for people to gain international experience. Now, in terms of how you deliver international experience, there's an argument as to whether that has to be through physical mobility by moving people around the world, or whether you can do that through virtual or remote working. And that's why this has become so topical. And then, of course, there's the mixture as well, the hybrid work that you mentioned, where people go on an international assignment but still want to do some work remotely for personal reasons, potentially. So, yes, it's a big issue and still a very topical one.
Because the landscape's changed, hasn't it, since the pandemic? So pre-pandemic, we had a lot of business travel, a lot of assignments. They were seen as absolutely crucial to business development. Then we got used to working remotely, and companies quite liked the idea that they weren't spending too much money on assignments. And now we're at this sort of point where cost benefit is really important, and organisations are thinking, well, really, how much are we going to get in terms of return on investment in sending this person abroad? Or if they want to work remotely, but they want to work in another country, does that give them the kind of experience that they would get if they went off and worked on the ground instead?
Yes, I mean, I think the thing is during the pandemic, obviously, the global mobility landscape changed completely because people couldn't move around, full stop. It couldn't happen, you know, because of the restrictions in place on global travel. And also people got used to working from home. And for some people, they enjoyed it. Other people, they prefer to go into the office. So it is a sort of a thing of preference, I guess. But in terms of thinking about what people like to do, I think most people seem to have got the idea that it's quite pleasant to have some time working from home or working in a different location. So, for example, you know, you might go away on holiday, or you're visiting family who live in a different country and you'd like to stay a bit longer visiting your family, but at the same time carry on working. So, you know, is that, a possibility that companies might enable in some way or allow in some way? So in terms of the, you know, opportunities for people, I think the landscape, as you say, has changed. People like to have that freedom, I guess, to choose, the ability to have flexibility to be able to work where they want, when they want, at least for some of their working time, working lives. You asked about the difference it makes and the cost benefit. Companies have moved back now to sending people abroad. So the times of saying, yes, okay, everything can be done virtually has moved on. And even during the pandemic, not everything could be done virtually. There are jobs that have to be done face-to-face, particularly leadership roles, for example, or physical work, you know, sort of technical work where you have to physically be on site to do the jobs. So I think companies are feeling that it's now the time for people to be going back to move moving into international work and moving abroad physically, not doing everything remotely, as was the case during the pandemic. In terms of cost benefit, which you raised, it is costly to send people abroad. I mean, obviously, it depends on your policy and the type of assignment, but it's typically thought to cost around three times the cost of a domestic employee. So that sounds very expensive. But the return on investment from sending people is obviously higher than that, because if it wasn't higher than that, companies wouldn't send people because it wouldn't be cost efficient to do so. So, you know, there is a cost benefit positive outcome for moving people abroad. But then comes the question of, you know, what's the positive outcome in terms of cost benefits, in terms of combining moving people with remote working? Is it possible to do both? And does that have a cost benefit attached to it? And yes, it can do, because it's engaging for employees. It gives them the flexibility to do some work from home or in another country, as I just mentioned. So that's positive. And if that actually motivates them and raises their productivity, then that's a positive thing. But from a negative perspective, weighed against it, you've got to say, well, how does that translate to what it looks like in the local workforce? Are you allowing local people to do this flexible working as well? And if you are, then it looks equitable. But if you're not, is it equitable that your expatriate or international assignee is able to do this and your local people are not? So there's lots and lots of factors in play that companies need to consider.
That's a very good point. And it also brings in the point around diversity, because assignments can be particularly narrow in terms of who's chosen and who's considered suitable for an assignment. And companies, I think, are mindful these days that they need to be more diverse in their selection and encourage people to come forward. What kind of policy changes do organisations need to make to ensure that as wide a variety of candidates as possible has that opportunity to have international experience?
Yeah, I'll comment on the diversity angle first, if I may, if you're not able to physically move, and that can be the case, particularly for, individuals who have got children, particularly if they're in critical stages of education, it might not be easy to move at a particular point in time, or they might not be willing to disrupt their child. Then the opportunity to do some work virtually is obviously a way of widening out those assignment opportunities to people who aren't able to move. Obviously, in some locations of the world, there are, issues with regard to the movement of LGBT individuals, legal restrictions, for example, that would potentially be quite dangerous for them to go into those environments, doesn't necessarily mean that they can't take up those assignments, but virtual working would provide an alternative solution. Whether it provides virtual working provides the same outcomes in terms of cultural competence, though, is debatable, because you obviously gain far more cultural competence if you're there and you're on the ground. But nonetheless, it does open up the opportunities for people who otherwise potentially couldn't move. So it could be people who are in dual career couples, people with children at particular stages, people with health conditions, issues to do with sexual orientation and so on, that it can actually be beneficial for them. So it provides some international experience. There's an argument as to whether it provides the same depth and degree of cultural competence that you might get from physically going. Your second question, really, or interrelated with that, was about policy change, and that's obviously a huge area. And companies, I think, at the moment are grappling with this, to be honest. And the evidence that seems to be out there from the very limited survey evidence that's available, which is also based on quite small samples, so it's difficult to generalize from it. But what we're seeing is a very, very mixed approach as to what companies are doing in terms of whether they are having policies that directly encourage or support hybrid working or remote working. So there's a lot of variation going on there. And I think what's quite interesting is, because this is at such an early stage, organizations do tend to benchmark. They look at what everybody else is doing. But everybody else is kind of flapping around a bit, trying to work out what they are doing. So as a result, and I don't mean that in any sort of derogatory way, I think what they're doing is they're trying out different approaches to see what they think might work. And they're in new territory. This hasn't really been done before, the idea that you might send somebody on an international assignment and they want to work remotely for part of the time. And that hasn't really been part of the global mobility policy agenda up until now. So I think there's always an issue with benchmarking. Companies do tend to copy everybody else. And in a way, that's good because they can, you know, it sets a trend and people kind of know what to do. But at the same time, I think they have to also find their own way and do something that suits their own company culture. So benchmarking isn't necessarily always the solution, but it's always good to see what everyone else is doing, even if you decide that it's not for you and you want to do something different. So we're seeing a real mixed bag, I think, with policy changes at the moment. It's very, very varied as to how companies are approaching this, with no clear trend in evidence yet. So it's a bit of a wait and see, I suppose, but always very good to discuss with other people what they're doing, but more importantly, why they're doing it, how it fits with their own culture of what's acceptable or the norm within their company. You can't just mimic or copy everybody else, really.
Fiona, does that tally with what you're hearing on the ground, that it is a bit of a state of flux and organisations are trying to establish what would be best in class for their organisational culture?
Yes, I think that is the case. And I think it varies across different industry sectors as well. I mean, say, whether they're trying to forge a path into some new region overseas, whether it's a structural thing like the whole of the engineering, whether it's civil engineering, whether it's mechanical engineering or in the technology side, those are extremely expert people who need to be on the ground in different locations, and there are extreme skills shortages. So you have to juggle those things plus the diversity of your workforce. And what team you need there at any one time, plus people bidding for new contracts all the time, which are coming up, and markets going up and down around the world, as well as other cultural issues, as Sue mentioned, whether they're really having a drive to engage their employees and different demographics. And I think as Sue was highlighting, it's a bespoke, getting to be a bespoke solution per company. And just as the employees are wanting a bespoke situation for themselves as individual international assignments. So I think there's a lot of accommodating also being done by the relocation management companies and the destination service providers, plus even the schools on the family side as to how they manage all this change going on at different levels. And not to mention, as we'll come on to, huge changes across industry sectors grappling with new technology and advances. So it's certainly not a very even situation.
So that's a good point, isn't it, Sue, that companies are feeling their way towards a policy that's suitable for them and their employees. But is there also a sense of managing expectations that employees perhaps don't see the stakeholders and the complexity that's behind making a decision on whether or not they're going to enable and support remote working, versus employees just seeing it as kind of something that's almost a right now?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, actually. And companies need to think about whether they've got policies that they can institute to make these points more sort of solid, and more, you know, solid framework that they can point employees to. And I agree with you. I think during the pandemic, it became necessary to work remotely. So people get used to it and think they can continue to do it. And they don't necessarily understand that there are immigration or sort of tax compliance issues that can prevent them doing it. So, you know, you go on holiday somewhere and you sit on a beach under a palm tree and you think, gosh, this is nice. Wouldn't I like to work here for another couple of weeks? And why can't my employer pay for this? And to start with, there's no rationale why the employer should pay for it other than to kind of keep the employee motivated. But can they do that? What are the sort of immigration and the tax compliance issues behind it? And those do need to be checked out first before employers can agree. So that may well be why a lot of policy decisions are just being left to handling on a case-by-case basis, because it depends, you know, where in the world this is, whether the employer has got another establishment in that location or not, you know, what the tax and legal jurisdictions are. So that's sort of a key thing. But I also think with regard to policy, so just linking back to the earlier question that you posed to me, is that organisations have got to think about, you know, how long do you allow this for? You know, is this, are you going to allow someone to be on an international assignment and do remote working for, well, how long? You know, 1 month, 2 months, a whole year? Where do you draw the line? So what we're seeing is different approaches looking at sort of caps on how long people can work remotely in other countries, you know, through their own choice. And those could be, you know, sort of number of consecutive days or sort of so many days per month, say, or cumulative, how many days in a year, or some sort of mix of consecutive and cumulative caps. We're seeing that happening. And again, there's no, you know, definitive way to do this. It's a mixed approach. Companies are doing it differently, probably reflecting their objectives, the, you know, their company culture, the locations in which they're operating, and so on. But of course, what they're trying to do with their policies is they're trying to get this mix, aren't they? You know, this idea of meeting business objectives, but also trying to improve the employee experience. So Fiona said it's a juggling act, and it is a juggling act. You're trying to enhance your employee experience and your talent retention, and at the same time, you've got to meet business objectives, and you can't transgress, you know, any compliance issues. So, yeah, juggling act, I think. And that may well reflect why we're seeing such a, dare I call it, a mishmash. It's a, you know, a mix of different approaches with different people trying out different things. And at the end of the day, well, great, you know, if it works, then that's the way to go. But I do think that HR professionals and global mobility professionals need to take care on this, because the compliance issues can be quite difficult to navigate. And, you know, there's solutions out there. There's online solutions. There's sort of face-to-face company provider type solutions. So they're out there. It's just a question of being sure that you're not, you know, doing anything that is damaging to not only your company, actually, in terms of costs, but also the employee. They don't want to be transgressing tax or sort of visa compliance regulations either.
That's an interesting point, Fiona, isn't it? That it's a juggling act, but it's also one for service providers, those that are on the ground, schools as well, because they're seeing a change in the way assignments are organised and enjoyed. And that has an impact on their policy, on their recruitment, on the service that they're providing. What kind of trends are you seeing from the service providers and the schools with that respect?
Well, we'll find out a lot more when we have our online schools fair in November, but certainly the picture we're picking up, there is something about different ages of children and the costs cutting that's being driven by employers, and this menu of choice for the individual employees. They're having to make decisions about trade-offs between, say, where they live, the location they live in, the school, and what age the children are, whether they would go opt for an international school, a private school, a state school, or the equivalent in whatever country they are, and at what stage and level of education they would wish to spend more of their allowances on education, and at what stage they want to spend it more on the housing or lifestyle issues. Because I think since the pandemic, the individual employees have also got a stronger sense of what they want personally about out of this international experience and their job, and also their partner, there may be two of them negotiating over this. So it is about weighing things up and perhaps changing the situation when your children move to different age ranges. So I know that some schools are physically changing their buildings to accommodate lower school and primary school children in other buildings, and then upgrading facilities and classrooms for older children at secondary level, and then also boarding, which is an option. So if an assignee is given the option to be based in a country for a considerable time and travel, work within a wider region, say in Europe or Asia, then they can elect to put their children in a boarding school and or a school that offers boarding. So that's also, I understand that the boarding situation is proving very popular with international families to allow that sort of thing, particularly dual career.
So it's an industry in flux. There's lots of pressure. There's lots of change. Global mobility professionals need support, don't they? And Think Global People have come up with a support network and a membership scheme that they can join if to share these initiatives, best in class ideas and discussions. And there's more about that on the website, isn't there, Fiona, about the membership structure, networking events, webinars, how you can join and participate and learn.
Yes, exactly. That's why we started this membership, and the Think Global People aspect of Relocate Global is so that we can have more exchange of ideas, both from the corporate sector and the relocation management companies, as well as those who are working in international environments and want to tap in to what's happening in best practice organisations, the big organisations that may do things one way, or an industry sector, how they're dealing with a problem. So I think it's very much about teasing out solutions. So we'll be offering a whole suite of things to support everybody across global mobility, leadership, and of course the employment and engagement of the people working internationally.
So Sue, a lot of change, a very fast moving industry, lots of challenges for global mobility professionals. Any sort of final thoughts or comments on trends that we might see through in 2024?
I just think that possibly in terms of the sort of policy design, it's going to be interesting to see whether organisations continue their sort of what they were doing, which was to sort of increase the number of formal policies that they have. Aligning them with, you know, different lengths or different patterns of mobility or different levels of seniority or, you know, volunteer assignees, or whether they're going to stop doing that and just, you know, so in other words, if I continue on that theme, they would have a specific policy for remote working and a specific policy for hybrid working and so on. So extending the numbers of policies in their suite, or whether they are going to follow the idea more towards flexibility. And if so, whether they would then move to more of a guideline approach. So we've seen a trend moving towards having more defined policies, narrowing it down in a way so that you slot into particular policy groups, but within those policy groups, more flexibility, and flexibility in order to allow choice, which is Fiona's point. And the point about choice is choice enhances or encourages diversity. So that's one route they could go. And the other route is to move more towards fewer policies, but just general published guidelines, such that there's a guideline approach that gives even more flexibility, even more choice. But then there's always a danger with choice. You know, do employees make the right choices? And, you know, Fiona mentioned things like, you know, they might want to go down a lifestyle route, or they might want to go down, you know, some other route. And then employers have to think, well, OK, that might be good for the family or the employee, but is that exactly what the business wants? Is that actually going to meet business objectives? So it's like a set of scales, isn't it? Going up and down one side or the other side. Do you want to go for a more formal policy, or do you want to go for a guideline approach, or do you want something in between that provides flexibility, that gives employees choice, enhances the employee experience, but at the same time, the underlying mantra has to be meeting business objectives. It has to be. That is why companies are in business. That is why they're sending employees abroad.
So it's a challenge for companies to keep that communication going, to make policy clear to employees, to really communicate why they're doing things, what they're doing them for, and perhaps also to keep open the lines of communication and debate with employees so that they can get some feedback as well. It's not just a one-way street.
It's communication with employees, and as Fiona says, it's communication with other employers. You do need to find out what everybody else is doing, because benchmarking is quite useful. It just means you shouldn't be a slave to it, though. I mean, what you need to do is find out what everyone's doing, but find out why. I think that's the key thing. It's not copying. It's deciding what might work best for you. And you get ideas through networking and through discussion with other people. And I think that's always the best way to go. But I hope to see more variety, actually. It makes life more interesting, doesn't it, when you see more variety in what companies are doing, and understanding the context in which they're operating, because context is always, it's key to it, really. It really is.
A fascinating note to end on. Thank you so much, Dr. Sue Shortland from the University of Westminster and Fiona Murchie, Managing Editor of Relocate Global and Think Global People. That was our investigation and podcast into hybrid working in global mobility. Thank you so much for joining us, and look out for some more really fascinating podcasts in the series, where we'll be covering family support, ESG and other topics which are absolutely vital and current to the global mobility industry. Thank you both so much.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, Marianne. Thank you, Fiona.